Τέτοια καρδιά που έχεις εσύ, αμάν αμάν ούτε Θεό φοβάσαι. Πουρκαλά είμαι χριστιανός, δεν με
slow computer again, folks, which means, at least for the beginning of the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, May the 19th, 2014, finally getting underway at 3:06 p.m. going to have to resort to good old this is the Mideast Migraine Show. On Free Radio Santa Cruz. Streaming online at freakradio.org. And broadcasting at 101.3 FM. It's 3:08, and you were subjected to 3.5 minutes of utterly, just plain stupid dead air. Because of my inability to calm down and think here. You know what it is when you're down to the wire. You've got just a couple of a minute or two before you need to go on the air, and your computer freezes up. Just decides to go on break or go on strike and stop working. So I had my hands full of that. And it, not wanting to cooperate, forces me to resort to good old-fashioned paper and print. I'm going to start off this show with the headline, Massachusetts. Pledge of Allegiance, not religious. By Paige Sutherland of Associated Press, Boston AP. The Pledge of Allegiance does not discriminate against atheists and can be recited at the start of the day in public schools, Massachusetts' highest court ruled on Friday. The Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts said the words, "Under God," in the pledge, reflect patriotic practice, not a religious one. They acknowledge that the wording has a, quote, religious tinge, end quote, but said it is fundamentally patriotic and voluntary. The court was ruling a 2010 lawsuit filed by an atheist family from Acton, Massachusetts, who claimed that the daily recital of the pledge in classrooms... Something brewing back there. The court was ruling in a 2010 lawsuit filed by an atheist family from Acton who claimed that the daily recitation of the pledge in classrooms violated their three children's equal protection rights under the state constitution, which protects against discrimination. The family was not identified in the lawsuit. I'll touch upon the possible reasons why it was not identified after I read this. Stephen Mills, the superintendent of the Acton-Boxborough Regional School District, said officials were pleased with the ruling. Quote, "It is a pledge of national loyalty, not a prayer," he said, adding that the district paid about $60,000 in legal fees to fight the lawsuit. "We will continue to respect every child's right to recite the pledge or not," Mills added. David Nwash, an attorney representing the family in the American Humanist Association, said in a statement Friday that, quote, No child should go to public school every day from kindergarten to grade 12 and be faced with an exercise that portrays his or her religious group as less patriotic. A lower court judge ruled in 2012 that the inclusion of... Have some music, folks. Stand by, please. Everyone out there who hears my voice is keeping in mind the fact that this is a totally community and dedicated programmer supported radio service. Free Radio Santa Cruz. We are non-compliant with federal communications commissions edicts about what we can and cannot say and when we can say it, and all these various things that are really corporately owned and controlled. That's the reason why this radio service is in service. We make do with what we have, which is absolutely minimal. I am the only person in the studio. We are a community radio station, pirate underground radio service. I am alone here. When calls come in, I have to answer them or otherwise deal with them as I see fit. Sometimes the timing is just terrible. I had to deal with that. All right. Now, this, in all the glorious horse shittiness of the quality so far, this is the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, May 19th, 2014. It is now 3:16 in the afternoon. I'm going to start this sucker from the very beginning. Mitty's Migraine Show. First item from MSN. Massachusetts, Pledge of Allegiance, Not Religious. By Paige Sutherland of the Associated Press, Boston, AP. The Pledge of Allegiance does not discriminate against atheists and can be recited at the start of the day in public schools. Massachusetts highest court ruled Friday. The Supreme Judicial Court said the words under God, quote unquote, under God in the pledge reflect patriotic practice, not a religious one. They acknowledge that the wording has a, quote, religious tinge, but said it is fundamentally patriotic and voluntary. The court was ruling in a 2010 lawsuit filed by an atheist family from Acton, Massachusetts, who claimed that the daily recitation of the pledge in classrooms violated their three children's equal protection rights under the state constitution, which protects against discrimination. The family was not identified in the lawsuit. Stephen Mills, the superintendent of the Acton-Boxborough Regional School District, said officials were pleased with the ruling. Quote, it is a pledge of national loyalty, not a prayer, he said, adding that the district paid about $60,000 in legal fees to fight the lawsuit. We will continue to respect every child's right to recite the pledge or not, Mills added. David Nwash, an attorney representing the family and the American Humanist Association, said in a statement Friday that no child should go to school, to public school every day from kindergarten to grade 12 and be faced with an exercise that portrays his or her religious group as less patriotic. End quote. A lower court judge ruled in 2012 that the inclusion of Under God did not violate the school's anti-discrimination policy or state law. The family appealed. Did not violate the school's anti-discrimination policy or state law. The phrase Under God, which was added to the pledge in 1954, has been the subject of numerous lawsuits over the years. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that students cannot be compelled to recite the pledge, nor punished for refusing to recite it. End of article. I made a few copies of this and attended my monthly Santa Cruz Atheists meetup group at our seasonal favorite hangout downtown this month. And I was a little late. Turned out they had already talked about it, so no one had much more to say to me. But here's my take on this stuff. The article says that the pledge does not discriminate against atheists and can be recited at the start of the day in public schools. The Supreme Court says that the words under God in the pledge reflect patriotic practice, not a religious one. I'm not going to argue that the pledge reflects patriotic practice. I mean, what does the word reflects mean anyway? That's kind of, could be very broad. It could be very shallow. To reflect something, it's almost an escape valve, meaning you're not held to something. But the pledge reflecting patriotic practice simply means that there's some history behind the usage of the pledge and events that led up to someone deciding that the pledge needs to be taken. I believe that the actual Pledge of Allegiance was written in the 1800s, probably during or after our Civil War, because some grown-up out there decided that they needed to instill patriotic values in the children. It's kind of hard to argue against that in a time of war, or after a war which devastated much of the United States, at least in the South. And so it's patriotic. But then they claim that it's not a religious pledge. Another escape valve. You actually say, in so many words, under God. Those words being added by some preacher who pushed for instilling upon children reciting the pledge in school their fact that there is a God, and that that is at least as important as patriotism to your nation. So I think the court is wrong in saying that the pledge is not a religious pledge. It's not. They admit it has a religious tinge, but is fundamentally patriotic and voluntary. It's how do you measure something like that, folks? That most people feel, or that the overwhelming feel of the pledge itself is more patriotic than it is religious? Is it just a matter of counting up all the words and saying the 50-odd words in 30, 40, 50-odd words in the whole pledge compared to two that say under God puts the whole matter to rest right there? Now, the thing about the family not being identified in the lawsuit. It's important to remember that there is, out in the religious community, a strain of vindictiveness, a strain of religious, deistic might against the forces of atheism or agnosticism, that they have to protect themselves. You had the Defense of Marriage Act once upon a time, which has been tossed aside by our Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court. This is like defense of God, which, of course, for the truly faithful, many of the truly faithful out there, it goes far and above the laws of man. The law of God supersedes the law of man. I think until we evolve to a point where we can finally decide how the two of those unify, law of man, law of God. Until then, there's going to be this fervor among some of the deeply fundamentalist religious that there's nothing any court in the land can tell me that should interfere with my right to express my religion as I see fit, even if that has to do with disallowing non-legally married individuals to take an apartment in the building that they own until they marry or separate and buy two apartments and pay for those, or whether you're talking about their perceived right to push upon little kids the demand that they pledge allegiance to God, in effect. It doesn't say, "I pledge allegiance to God" in the pledge. But in the minds of little kids, I don't think they make that discernment very easily. So, as far as the family not being identified in the lawsuit, clearly trying to protect themselves against the vindictively religious, who may or may not assault them or picket their house, or make threatening or silent crank calls at 2 or 3 in the morning. And I and other members of my family have been subject to that kind of abuse. The price we pay for being who we are and saying what we want to say. So, you know, this has happened before. And the family has good reason to not want to be blackballed or otherwise abused if they happen to tell the world who they are. And that gets us to probably the most important concrete aspect of this whole story. On the one hand, Mr. Mills of the Acton Roxborough School District, Acton Boxborough School District, Regional School District, says, we will continue to respect every child's right to recite the pledge or not. So some have a right to recite a pledge which was written up for them. And so the right was determined by showing it in their faces every morning. And again, in the non-discerning or minimally discerning minds of young children, you just go with it. You go along with it. And as for the right to not do it, that's what you had to begin with, because you weren't born with that written pledge shoved into your face. So it's like, is somebody going to come along and grab you by the scruff of the neck and say, yes or no, are you going to pledge this? Are you going to say it every morning? So if they say no, they don't simply say no and either remain standing with the other kids, perhaps not putting their right hand over their heart and keeping their mouth shut, or if they remain seated, someone's going to notice that some other kids who were brought up by religious, perhaps zealously religious parents, are going to notice this. And the children right then and there are identified. And there have been incidents and articles written about these incidents where the kids, those children who are exercising their right, as it says here, not to pledge, or even if it's only not say the words under God, are, you know, you say the pledge, sit down, have the school until the first recess, then you end up in the schoolyard and the bullies come out of the woodwork and they start kicking you around and saying things like, hey, what's wrong with you? How come you're not pledging with the rest of us? The teachers can't keep an eye on this stuff, and even if they do watch it from a distance, if it's anything like it was when I was a kid some 50-odd years ago in school, in those earliest grades, chances are the teachers are not going to interfere with the bullies. It's going to, you know, they have this eternal mantra going through, like, hey, they have to learn one way or another. This is life. Let them find out for themselves. This is at an early age. This is what they need to know in order to prepare yourself to buy a pair of fitting boots and then pull yourself up by those bootstraps. One way or another, non-reciters of the pledge, even if it's minimally obvious to the other children or perhaps to teachers and other adults in the room, may very well end up paying for it, and sometimes do. They are relegated. They are isolated from the other members of the oh-so God-fearing classroom occupants, and they become identified as such, put down, made to feel less important, less human, less worthy, because they don't say the Pledge of Allegiance. And that really, in my mind, is what this all comes down to. The courts, this Mr. Mills of the school district and the people he represents, and attorneys for the defense, I guess, in this case, all of those guys are missing the point. I'm not an attorney myself, but that's my perfectly valid personal view of it. Last paragraph says, the phrase under God, which was added to the pledge in 1954, has been the subject of numerous lawsuits over the years. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that students cannot be compelled to recite the pledge, nor punished for refusing to recite it. Well, at least the highest court in the land gives some attention to the fact that some kind of punishment may be afforded those who refuse to recite it, but they could just be talking about formal punishment by teachers or by the principal when you're sent to the principal's office for not reciting it. Okay, so they've addressed formal sanctioned form of punishment, but it pays no direct attention to the other bullying in the schoolyard ways that kids are punished for not saying the pledge. All right. Now, I do think it's important to talk about things other than Israelis and Palestinians and their little problems or their great big problems. So that is part of the reason why I wanted to pass this along to someone. I brought it to my Santa Cruz Atheists group monthly meeting this month, and they had already been talking about it a little bit, so they didn't give it all the attention I wanted them to, but at least they spoke about it. So I wanted to read this to somebody and spout off myself here. But I think there's a tie-in to what goes on in Palestine and Israel. You have these dichotomies, these inherent contradictions of Israel, the democratic state, which also wants to be recognized and declared by the whole world, including the native Palestinians, as a Jewish state. A democratic state, but a Jewish state, where one out of every five citizens of Israel is not Jewish. And interestingly enough, I doubt very much that this is a coincidence, but interestingly enough, many of those non-Jewish citizens of Israel are losing their rights every day. More and more of their rights to property, to travel, to settlement, to residency, to education, and to public service administration are being usurped from them. Muslims, Muslim Arabs, Christian Arabs, other Arabs who are not religious at all and not Jewish, have been steadily taking a back seat farther and farther from the front. And as it is, in many cases, especially in the case of Jerusalem, the Jewish people and their neighborhoods and their residences get first priority one way or another. Whether or not it's written down according to any law, someone up there decides they're the ones who have their plumbing fixed the first, their rodentia eradicated first, structural flaws in the old buildings, and this is very clearly a safety issue, this public safety issue, those problems are taken care of on a first priority basis, and the Arabs have to wait sometimes for many, many months before they get that kind of service, and some of them never get it. Some of them end up moving out. There is a lot of charges and indications that this is, it's not a coincidence that Arabs decide to leave, and that's only if they have the opportunity to go someplace else that's adequate to their personal and familial needs. That it's not a coincidence that there are those in the Israeli and Jerusalem municipal bureaucracy who are committing this crime on a deliberate basis in order to free up all of Jerusalem for Jews and Jews only. This is what Zionism is all about. Zionism initially, at least according to the public's understanding and acceptance of it, simply meant establishing a national home for the Jews of the world, in one specific geographic place. And it seemed as though no one, or next to no one, was paying any attention to the fact that there were hundreds of thousands, if not 1 or 2 million, natives to the land who spoke Arabic, many of whom consider themselves to be Palestinian. This is going back over 100 years ago when Zionism came about, in the very late 1800s. No one seemed to notice that those Arabs had rights too. It's the exact same thing as the white Europeans coming to the New World and finding that they were not the only human beings there. They weren't the only humming beings there. And what does this have to do with the Pledge of Allegiance and court rulings about it? You've got a Jewish state, which purports to be a Jewish state, but also purports to be a democracy and inevitably cannot or will not treat everyone with equality, with the favored people tending to fall along religious lines. And, there's a lot of this going on in the Islamic world, too. It's just as bad, and it needs to be addressed. Only, it's like pulling teeth in the case of any given Arabic or Islamic state, which in many cases has had this going culturally, embedded in that culture for centuries or over 1,000 years. You cannot extricate it at a moment's notice or on short order. Israel, which is supposed to be a democracy, addresses some of these concerns, but remarkably continues its inexorable march towards expelling their non-believers, or the non-believers in their midst. It is precisely because Israel has a democratic mechanism, which falls way, way short of what it's supposed to be doing, that one can expect these kind of changes to take place in Israel with minimal obstruction from the establishment, from the government, from the culture, from the bureaucracies. Okay, I'm really getting away with my wordiness here. If you're talking about a Pledge of Allegiance in America to our flag, where someone decided you cannot pledge allegiance to a country without pledging allegiance to God, is that all that different from everyone, whether they're Jewish or not, to pledge allegiance to Yahweh, Yehovah, Jehovah? Can you live there without making such pledges and stay on an equal basis with everyone else? Now, here's a regular column which appears in every monthly issue of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the Santa Cruz branch. The Undaunted Dove is the name of the publication. Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Santa Cruz, WILF. This is Margaret Knight's column, Shalom, Salam, Peace, Reports of the Middle East Cluster. And this would be, I believe, the most recent one, the May issue. April or May issue. It says, if Israel is a Jewish state, what about non-Jews who were about half the total population of Israel and Palestine? I said a moment ago that 1 out of every 5 Israeli Arabs, Israeli citizens are not Jewish. 20%. Those are just, I'm just talking about the citizens of Israel who live within the borders of the internationally accepted nation of Israel. I was not including those Arabs who number at least a couple or 3 million in the occupied territories, East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. I was not including those non-Jewish Muslims and Christians primarily. So Margaret Knight asked the question, if Israel is a Jewish state, what about non-Jews who are about half the total number of Israel-Palestine, including the territories? She says, one answer could be a two-state condominialism. Condominialism. First time I've seen that word. One answer could be two-state condominialism. The state of Palestine would be the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, and only Palestinians could be citizens. The state of Israel would be for Jews, and only Jews could be citizens. The states would be democracies and would accept all people of their diaspora as Israel does now. In condominialism, citizenship is defined by religion and ethnicity. Many Palestinians are Christian, rather than where Jews and Palestinians live. Here's where condominialism gets complicated. Palestinians and Jews could settle anywhere in Israel-Palestine, and no matter where they lived, they would be citizens of their own state. Palestinians who now are citizens of Israel would have the permanent right to live in Israel and have the benefits they now have as Israelis, but would be citizens of Palestine. And she warned us, here's where it gets complicated. All other Palestinians would have the right to live and work in Israel or Palestine, would remain citizens of Palestine with rights and benefits given under Palestinian law. Jews could live anywhere in Israel or Palestine, including the West Bank and East Jerusalem. They would be citizens of Israel and vote in Israeli elections. Each state would be Each state would be responsible for the welfare of its citizens. This would include providing education, health care, unemployment insurance, pensions, law enforcement, utilities, etc. Water, not distributed equally now, would be under a United Nations commission. Actually, condominialism is not so different from the early Arab Caliphate, where Islamic law and the Islamic State were only for Muslims, Jews, and Christians. Actually, condominialism is not so different from the early Arab Caliphate, where Islamic law and the Islamic State were only for Muslims. Jews and Christians were protected peoples, quote, people of the book, who lived in their own communities under their own laws. In condominialism, each state would be fully sovereign, similar to the early Arab Caliphate. Nor is condominialism so different from our overseas military bases, where Americans live in a foreign country under our own laws with our own government services. Separate and independent worked well enough in the early Arab Caliphate and works in our overseas military bases. Margaret Knight ends her article with this paragraph. Would two-state condominialism resolve such emotional issues as security, borders of the two states, the right of return of Palestinian refugees, and the Jewish settlements in the West Bank? It could. That's how she ends the paragraph, remarkably. Would two-state condominialism resolve such emotional issues as security, borders of the two states, the right of return of Palestinian refugees, and the Jewish settlements in the West Bank? It could. I am almost aghast that Margaret Knight, who clearly is in a degree of solidarity with the Palestinian Arabs, would stand by this nonsense. Why are people so obsessed with putting up boundaries of any kind, whether they are actual geographic borders guarded by checkpoints, military personnel, aircraft monitoring? I mean, even if you have... One thing Margaret Knight here is professing is that this is a feasible arrangement to, in part to maintain the status quo, because you've got a bunch of Palestinian Arabs who are not Jewish, who live in Israel proper, who go about their lives not as though they're totally unimpeded by Israeli law, who considers themselves Palestinian and not really Israeli at heart, but of course they take advantage of some of the freedoms and opportunities they have in an Israeli state. So this, for Margaret, for Ms. Knight here, to maintain the status quo of their lives and have it be sanctioned by law. I just don't see why everything has to follow so closely along the lines of separation, of apartheid of one form or another, of geographic borders. I mean, to me it all comes down to the question, what really is the value of Zionism? There was a time when it was seen by many Jews as clearly the only way for the Jewish people in the diaspora around the world to have their basic human rights recognized and protected. That instead of them being isolated from their countries around the globe, that they all unite in one place where they could supposedly thrive, prosper, and live in peace and security. But what of the native Arabs? Some try to make the argument that there's no such thing as a native Arab on several counts. For one thing, you cannot call Arabs who live in the former Empire of Israel, established some 2.5 millennia ago, almost 2,500 years ago, 2,300 years ago. You cannot call Arabs natives because the Jews were there first, which automatically condemns every last Arab and every last ancestor of each living Arab as trespassers, intruders, as people who didn't belong there to begin with. This flies in the face of what happens all over the world. Is someone going to sit down with pen and paper and make a chart and try to delineate who exactly belongs to every piece of land according to where their ancestors lived, and then try to enforce that? The reality in Israel and Palestine is the reality of people who are alive and affected by these notions of right and wrong. There are people who are living today who survived the events of late 1947, 1948, 1949, the time around which the modern state of Israel was declared and came into being. 1948, there are still people who are alive. They and their children and grandchildren are affected by those events. And there are certainly people who were alive in 1967 when Israel launched its surprise attack on the balance of historic Palestine, plus the entire Sinai Peninsula up to the very Suez Canal itself, plus the southwestern corner of Syria, the Golan Heights. With the exception of the Sinai Peninsula, all of which they still hold on, and I am including the Gaza Strip, because it is recognized, the economic siege which is laid upon the Gazan Palestinians by Israel is considered to be de facto occupation when you have an army which not only monitors its potential access points by land, by air, and by sea all the time anyway, and highly restricts who can go in and out or when they can go in and out. That is a de facto occupation. So Gaza is still occupied. The West Bank is clearly still occupied and impinged upon by a growing Jewish population. All this stuff is against international law, the activity of the Israelis, and for good reason. And they still hold on to Syria's Golan Heights. And it is Israel who, by far, I went to an event last night, Syria in Crisis, at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Fascinating information came across. Turns out Israel has by far broken far more ceasefires with the Syrians than the other way around, supposedly all for the state of Israel. But of course, for some time now, Israel has been settling the Golan Heights of Syria with more Jewish settlements, which they're not supposed to be doing. And they know the world has no power to stop them from doing it, particularly with the U.S. backing them on the Security Council of the United Nations. They do it because they can get away with it. And now, in recent months, they are busy trying to extract oil. Liquid petroleum oil from Syria's Golan, which rightfully belongs to the Syrian Arabs. So how did I get going on that? Yeah. This is the monstrosity that Zionism has become. Claiming the land for the Jews and the Jews only, utterly at the cost of everyone else whose lives are affected by it, by hook or crook. Zionism, which was designed to be a saving activity for an entire peoples of a particular faith, has become one of the most, in my eyes, hypocritical, table-turning, monstrous activities in the 20th and 21st centuries. So I guess I'll forgive Margaret Knight for at least, certainly for talking about what she refers to as condominialism, one form of the two-state solution, which allows people to continue exercising the best of the rights and opportunities that they have, regardless of where they live in that immediate area. But I see it as a big, big mess. You're still going to have Jews living amongst Arabs and Arabs living amongst Jews in each other's respective countries, which is trying to maintain, each of which tries to maintain its character of being Palestinian or Israeli or exclusively of one faith or another. And I, myself, am simply a one-stater. I prefer the old-fashioned one-state solution, which for centuries, Palestine could have been, and on occasion has strived to be. But it's been, you know, it's remarkable. The Israelis have succeeded in dividing Palestine for their purposes, at the expense of the natives. And yet you have these Christian fundamentalists who go running around shouting, Israel must never be divided again. It must be the land of God for God's people. The land of God's people, his chosen people, undivided. Well, it's Israel is the one who came around and divided it into two to begin with. And the fact that they invaded and took over the rest of historic Palestine, former British Mandate Palestine, is okay because it, in a sense, it makes it whole again. It puts the rest of the country under military occupation, with the Arabs under occupation having no real political rights, having no real human rights. So, well, let's swing on over to our little computer here. Oh, I'm so angry because I was writing an important letter. We're having, Free Radio Santa Cruz is having its monthly meeting this evening, shortly after my program. That's just a matter of schedule. It happens to be held an hour after my program ends. So I think what I'm going to do is it's 5 minutes to four. We're going to take our musical break, and I'm going to try to dispatch this sucker off here. You're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show, the Monday, May 19th, 2014 edition. on Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval.
You know. εσένα μας αγαπώ. Φωνιάς θα γίνω, μα δεν σ' αφήνω. Για θα σε πάρω, για θα χαθώ.
I feel like I've been buying time here. I'm having some serious problems accessing the material that I intended to for the show. And I am indeed sorry for my readers that it's not coming off the way I'd like my program to come off today. Now I'm frantically looking for stuff that I can talk about. Like every self-respecting executive type, I really do need to buckle down and clean out my briefcase. Portfolio. What are the other fancy, tight-ass names they have for some of these things? It's just so shameful. I can't even use my... can't even access my inbox. And yeah, I'm going to go ahead and read one of my favorite pieces yet again. This is the third time that I've exposed y'all to this. But since we're on the subject of, amongst a few other things... one chosen people of the God versus another people, whether or not those other people consider themselves to be chosen by God. This is called The Ghettos of Jerusalem. I'm talking about the division of ancient Palestine and the resurrection of someone's idea of a Jewish state. This goes back to January of 2010. I forget exactly where I got it from, but it is offered to us by the Green Olive Collective. It's written by Fred Shlomka, who is an Israeli social entrepreneur and the owner of www.toursinenglish.com. Mr. Fred Shlomka. This is really fascinating. The Ghettos of Jerusalem. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that, and I quote, "Jerusalem is the eternal capital of the Jewish people, a city reunified so as never again to be divided," end quote. I'll say that again. Netanyahu says, "Jerusalem is the eternal capital of the Jewish people, a city reunified." Reunified so as never again to be divided, end quote. Shlomka says here, nothing could be further from the truth. Jerusalem today is a city dissected by walls and fences, divided by race, religion, and ethnicity, and traumatized by home demolitions, ethnic cleansing, and brutal government policies. The boundaries of modern Jerusalem include 38 square kilometers inside Israel proper, plus 70 square kilometers of the West Bank territory, conquered in 1967, reaching north towards Ramallah, south to Bethlehem, and halfway to the Dead Sea to the east, encompassing a total of 108 square kilometers. This is the modern Jerusalem and its boundaries, 108 square kilometers. Over one-third of the annexed territory was expropriated for building settlements and other infrastructure for the exclusive benefit of the Jewish population. Meanwhile, the 28 West Bank villages caught in the 1967 municipal expansion have been repeatedly squeezed by the city's planning strategy and are now being strangled by the new developments of recent years. Referring again to 28 West Bank villages, suburbs of sorts, of Jerusalem. During the past 42 years, while Jewish settlements were rapidly being built, East Jerusalem Palestinians found it all but impossible to obtain building permits. However, many of them went ahead and built homes on their own land. Over 2,000 of these quote-unquote illegal houses have been demolished since 1967, and over 10,000 demolition orders are currently outstanding in the city. While Arab houses are routinely destroyed, the government meticulously plans and builds modern communities for Jews. The curious thing is that while claiming a united city, the Israeli government built the 25-foot-high concrete separation barrier that completely cuts off parts of the city of the east of the city by slicing through the middle of many neighborhoods. The government is also building segregated roads for Israelis and Palestinians within the Jerusalem envelope. This has resulted in a system of municipal cantons whose residents have different rights depending on whether they were already living in East Jerusalem in 1967, refugees, Israelis, or recent Jewish immigrants. Okay, listen closely to this, folks. This is the ever-so-united city of Jerusalem. Shlomka says, there are five categories of residents in Jerusalem. Jewish Israeli citizens, Arab Israeli citizens, Palestinian residents who live in neighborhoods annexed by Jerusalem after 1967, Palestinians registered as West Bank residents, and Palestinian refugees who were either expelled from Israel in 1948 or from the old city in 1967. So enjoy a little more music here. I've got to get this sucker sent off. Soundtrack going for a little mood enhancement. Back to this article by Fred Shlomka, The Ghettos of Jerusalem. I just read to you the five classifications. I'll read them again. For the kinds of people who live in Jerusalem. 1. Jewish Israeli citizens. 2. Arab Israeli citizens. 3. Palestinian residents who live in neighborhoods annexed by Jerusalem after 1967. 4. Palestinians registered as West Bank residents. Palestinian refugees who were either expelled from Israel in 1948 or from the old city in 1967. He goes on to say, the classification system results in a Machiavellian method of population control that violates human rights conventions and common decency. Common decency. Jewish Israelis have full civil rights and access to all the major roads in and out of Jerusalem. live in often luxurious settlement neighborhoods and receive government support in purchasing or otherwise obtaining property in Palestinian neighborhoods to further the policy of Judaizing. I think very easy for them to misspell these words. To further the policy of Judaizing as much of Jerusalem as possible. Or Judaizing as much of Jerusalem as possible. This is reflected in the string of Jewish settlement homes stretching through the Muslim quarter of the Old City and Palestinian neighborhoods such as Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah. Even as I write this article, I received an urgent SMS message from the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions that yet another home in Sheikh Jarrah has been taken over by settlers with high court approval. The settler organizations behind these efforts, such as Atzeret Kohanim and Elad, have an explicit religious nationalist strategy that informs all their activities and aim to undermine the possibility of a Palestinian state with its capital in East Jerusalem. In addition to the settler activity that drives Israeli wedges deep into Palestinian neighborhoods, the government has planned and built huge settlements that have become an integral and in many cases a contiguous part of the city. Ma'ale Adumim, to the east of Jerusalem, now has over 35,000 residents, and Pisgat Za'iv, in the northeast, over 65,000. The rapidly growing settlement of Gevat Ze'ev in North Jerusalem is now over 10 kilometers from the city center, forming a contiguous urban strip deep into the West Bank. Over 240,000 Jewish Israelis live in the Palestinian territories annexed to Jerusalem. Again, over 240,000. That's almost a quarter of a million Jewish Israelis live in the Palestinian territories that have been annexed to Jerusalem. As these settlements have extended the geographic boundaries of the city, they have encircled Palestinian areas, cutting them off from each other and thwarting their expansion. In recent years, the government has also surrounded many of these neighborhoods with walls and fences. For example, the adjacent communities of Bir Nabela, Al-Judiria, and Al-Jib are cut off to the east by an Israeli-only road, Route 443, to which the residents have no access. The Arab residents have no access. And to the west by the Gevat Ze'ev settlement. The area is also entirely surrounded by a wall, imprisoning over 10,000 people within. The residents can access the West Bank by only two roads, one of which goes through a tunnel under Route 443 and the wall, under the wall, leading eventually to Ramallah. A second 400-meter tunnel actually goes under a built-up area of Gevat Ze'ev, eventually reaching the West Bank village of Bidu, which itself is cut off from the rest of the West Bank by Route 443. Okay. Another Jerusalem canton is Anata, to the east of the city with a population of about 65,000. Once a separate village, about two-thirds of Anata, is within the annexed portion of Jerusalem, as is the adjacent Shuafat refugee camp. The eastern part of the village was assigned to the Palestinian Authority under the Oslo agreements. However, the wall now surrounds the entire village and the camp, with a single checkpoint leading to Jerusalem. Only Palestinians' Jerusalem ID cards, residents of the annexed portion of the village, are permitted to enter. Along the eastern side of the village, a new Arab-only road has been built, leading to the southern West Bank and north to Ramallah. This will eventually allow the villagers the, quote, privilege of traveling to these areas without going through checkpoints. None will be needed since the road has no exits and is lined with walls and barbed wire. In addition, the separation wall dissects the Jerusalem communities of Kufr Qab, Adudis, and Ar-Ram, destroying their community life. The residents are required to wait at checkpoints in order to enter Jerusalem, despite their legal residence in the city that confers the right under Israeli law to live and work in the municipality, albeit without the rights of citizenship. The complexity of Israel's management of Jerusalem and the various layers of rights, and lack of rights of the city's residents has enabled the Israeli government to incrementally extend the sovereignty of the state over the past 42 years while denying citizenship to non-Jewish residents. This has been done in full view of the world, with the acquiescence of successive White House administrations. The USA came to the forefront of the fight against apartheid. Why not against the Israeli version of separation, known as Hafrada in Hebrew? Both Hafrada and apartheid mean separation. Hafrada, a term used by government officials, is embodied in the walled ghettos, segregated roads, and multi-layered civil rights of Jerusalem's residents. The system is as reprehensible as the former system in South Africa. Israel has twisted the Jewish yearning for a homeland into a mockery of decent government and democratic ideals. Jerusalem, as the heart and soul of both Palestinian and Israeli aspirations, needs to become an open city shared by both peoples within the context of a just and lasting peace. Again, author Fred Shlomka is an Israeli social entrepreneur and the owner of toursinenglish.com. And again, this was offered to us through the Green Olive Collective. It cites a spread of years 2008 to 2012, so I guess that makes this strongly suggests to me that this article was written towards the end of that period, 2012, 2011, something like that. Are we hearing the resonating echoes of what I was talking about at the beginning of this program, Margaret Knight's description of, and perhaps even her endorsement of, condominiumalism? Condominium, I don't know if I'll ever say that word properly. I don't have the piece of paper in front of me anymore. Condominiumism? Now it's in front of me. Margaret Knight describes, and to some degree, in fact, she outright says in the very end of the article, it could work, the virtues of condominialism, a form of a two-state solution where people and their families themselves do not necessarily have to extricate themselves from where they live in either Israel or occupied territories or besieged territories like the Gaza Strip. They do not have to remove themselves from those areas in order to have rights afforded by the state which governs them. but they are still citizens of that particular state based on religion and ethnicity. So this Shlomka's description of Jerusalem, as it still exists very much today, an awful, ugly, millipedish octopus, one can say, of lengths of land that dissect neighborhoods, villages, and the native Arabs' way of life and their culture. Jerusalem is such a model for condominiumalism. So I think that was an excellent piece to read to you following Margaret Knight's report of the Middle East cluster in the latest issue of Wilf's newsletter, The Undaunted Dove. All right, what else can I possibly throw at you here, you know? Let's see if anything is happening more quickly here, so that I can get to... I think I finally may have access to the material that I prepared for you. And, yeah. Oh, boy, what a time to get bogged down, hey? This is the Mideast Migraine Show, perhaps to no one's surprise. In all of its shattered, mixed-up glory. Coming to you by way of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and we also stream live, even if what we're streaming live has been pre-recorded, at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. Click on the red oval to get that link. Okay. wait a minute, I did say... Here we go. I want to read to you this small piece, short piece about Boko Haram, the kidnappers of some 250 Nigerian girls from their school. May 15th, Saudi Arabia's top cleric says that Nigeria's Boko Haram smears Islam. Picture of protesters, one holding up a sign which reads in English, "What if this happened in America? #, bring our girls back." From Reuters, Gary Cameron, May 10th, Dubai, the city of Dubai. Saudi Arabia's Grand Mufti, the top religious authority in the birthplace of Islam, which is Medina, Saudi Arabia. The Grand Mufti has condemned Nigeria's Boko Haram as a group, quote, set up to smear the image of Islam, end quote, and condemned its kidnappings of over 200 schoolgirls. Sheikh Abdulaziz Al-Sheikh, I'll say it again, a lot of A's and A's in there. Sheikh Abdulaziz Al-Sheikh said the radical movement, Boko Haram, which says it wants to establish a, quote, pure Islamic state in Nigeria, was, and I quote, misguided and should be, quote, shown their wrong path and be made to reject it. His remarks came as religious leaders in the Muslim world, who often do not comment on militant violence, joined in denouncing Boko Haram leader Abu Bakar Shekau for saying Allah told him to sell off the kidnapped girls as forced brides. This is a group that has been set up to smear the image of Islam and must be offered advice, shown their wrong path, and be made to reject it, the Sheikh told the Arabic language newspaper Al Hayat in an interview published on Friday. These groups are not on the right path because Islam is against kidnapping, against killing, and against aggression, he said. Marrying kidnapped girls is not permitted. Marrying kidnapped girls, not permitted. Boko Haram militants kidnapped some 250 girls on April 14 from a secondary school in Shaibak village near the Cameroon border while they took exams. 50 of those girls have since escaped, so we're still talking about locating and freeing some 200 girls. Shekau's video was released on Monday, sparking a wave of revulsion in Nigeria and abroad and prompting offers of help from countries such as the United States, Britain, and France to search for them. Boko Haram has led a 5-year-old insurgency with the stated aim of reviving a medieval Islamic caliphate in modern Nigeria, whose 170 million people, whose 170 million people are split roughly evenly between Christians and Muslims. Again, this is a country of Nigeria, 170 million people. 5-year-old insurgency. Its violent attacks have become by far the biggest security threat to Africa's top oil producer, Nigeria, and it has spread out to menace the neighboring countries of Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. On Thursday, Islamic scholars and human rights officials of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the world's largest Muslim body representing 57 countries, denounced the kidnapping as, quote, a gross misinterpretation of Islam. This week, Al-Azhar, the prestigious Cairo-based seat of Sunni learning, also said that the kidnapping, quote, has nothing to do with the tolerant and noble teachings of Islam. Reporting by Sami Aboudi, editing by Tom Hennigan. Oh, way to go. That's some pretty swift editing. No, really. I'm just very cheap, cheesy attempted humor there. Well, you know, I for one certainly have heard authorities in the higher places of Islam denounce Islamic militancy and Islamic militants' actions as not consistent with the Quran, not consistent with the sayings of Muhammad and the teachings of the Islamic religion. They're probably right. May also depend on which part of the scripture you prefer to cite, but I generally give people who say these things the benefit of the doubt. When certain authorities step forward, the important thing here, probably the most critical thing pointed to in this article about the statement, says that they are statements made in unison among various high-level, broadly influential Islamic organizations. They are singing one song regarding Boko Haram. Okay, what else? I feel like I can breathe again. This sucker is going and going. I made up something for you last night. I probably left it in. Okay. Well, let's stick with talking about the quality of life between the average Jewish Israeli and the average non-Jewish Palestinian, be they Israeli citizen or under occupation here. I was looking at this, so I know. Oh, you know, you click on a link and it gives you the picture of the exact same thing you were just looking at. You know what that feels like? Let's try this one here. God, And I was just, I'm telling you, folks, I'm trying. I was just looking at this article yesterday. And now God is really laughing at me now. It's this morning I was doing something privately, and you press on the same buttons, and it shows you something completely different from the last thing you were looking at. Oh, what a joke.
don't tell me. It's the only way I can keep my sanity is to look on the bright side. Oh, why me? Obviously, this episode of MM is not going to go down in its own history as one of the shining lights in the series. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, streaming at whatever, freakradio.org. Click on the red oval. How about the other one that I wanted to show you? Come on. Here's an article from Haaretz, May 10th. That's almost 20 days ago. I thought it is worthy of note and even in its own grave, sickening manner, humorous. What was I saying a moment ago about keeping up your sense of humor? From Newsweek magazine, Israeli minister... This is from Haaretz, dated May 10th. Israeli minister speaking on a Newsweek report. He says, someone wants to sabotage U.S.-Israeli ties. The Strategic and Intelligence Affairs Minister, Yuval Steinitz, casts aspersions on allegations of, quote, aggressive Israeli espionage in the U.S. Again from Haaretz. A senior Israeli minister has come out against allegations in recent Newsweek reports of, quote, aggressive, end quote, Israeli espionage operations in the United States. Speaking to Channel 10 on Saturday, Strategic and Intelligence Affairs Minister Yuval Steinitz said that he suspects, quote, someone, end quote, is trying to cast aspersions on and compromise the cooperation between Israel and the United States. In Newsweek's latest report, the magazine revealed more details of alleged Israeli espionage spying in the United States just days before it quoted senior U.S. intelligence officials as saying that Israeli espionage operations in the United States have, and I quote, gone too far. So the magazine revealed more details of alleged Israeli espionage in the U.S. days after a quoted senior U.S. intelligence officials that Israeli espionage operations in the U.S. have gone too far, along with Steinitz, former military intelligence chief Amos Yadlin, also confronted the allegations, calling them, quote, absolutely baseless and, quote, strange. Let me be clear, said Yadlin in a Saturday interview on Channel 2. Israel is unequivocally not spying in the U.S., quote unquote. Yadlin is saying that Israel is unequivocally not spying in the U.S. Former Shin Bet chief, in the meantime, Carmi Gilon, also dismissed the allegations in an interview Saturday on Channel 10, saying that the idea was, and I quote, utterly improbable. While, quote, Israel has made many mistakes in its relationship with the United States, he, Carmi Gilon, said, I'm sure the lessons from the Pollard affair have been well learned. In reference to Jonathan Pollard, a man who was arrested and eventually convicted and is serving time in the United States for spying on the U.S. on behalf of Israel. That's who Pollard is. Subheading, Al Gore's Bathroom. In Newsweek's article by Jeff Stein, that was published on Thursday, and this was as of May 10th, he described a scene that could have easily belonged in a spy movie, or for that matter, a spy movie spoof, namely, an Israeli spy hiding in the air duct in Al Gore's bathroom in 1998. I have no idea what that means. According to a former U.S. intelligence operative quoted in the article, a Secret Service agent who was using the then vice president's restroom heard a metallic sound coming from the vent above him. And then, okay, so that's what this, let me start again, beginning of the Al Gore's bathroom section, so we have a more unified understanding of what we're talking about. In Newsweek's article by Jeff Stein that was published on Thursday, he described a scene that could have easily belonged in a spy movie, or for that matter, a spy movie spoof, an Israeli spy hiding in the air duct in Al Gore's bathroom in 1998. According to a former U.S. intelligence operative quoted in the article, a Secret Service agent who was using the then vice president's restroom heard a metallic sound coming from the vent above him. And then he sees a guy starting to exit the vent into the room, the official says, adding that after the agent coughed, the guy went back into the vents. Such incidents, claims the new report, were hushed up for one reason. The transgressor was Israel. Short report from Haaretz, probably not on its first page. Doesn't say who amongst its many, many writers, contributors, and columnists wrote that, but here are a few internet readers' comments. I have included five or six of the most popular, according to HIT, comments following the article. This one received 26 votes, according to vote anyway, by Alfie, 11 May. U.S.-Israel ties in this instance means uncritical U.S. support and funding for Israel. He goes on to say, more likely a meeting of higher-ups has decided that Israel has been a bit of a cormorant around America's neck recently, and Netanyahu's perceived ingratitude is being punished. Gilad, 11 May, says, Newsweek trash. The Arabs, with their oil money, believed they could impact public opinion in the West, so they poured their money into Newsweek and Time and got seats on the boards. Thankfully, they lost a fortune and did little on the impact side of things. Newsweek was purchased by IBT that has connections with the anti-Israel Presbyterian Church. They are sure to go down in the same way. Obviously a supporter of Israel. By labeling the American Presbyterian Church as anti-Israel refers to the National Presbyterian Church Central Organization as taking a stand with boycott, divestment, and sanctions, the BDS movement, and agreeing to the Presbyterian Church giving their blessing and recommendation that its members participate in officially cited BDS activities, boycotting certain cultural and academic institutions of Israel. A lot of bad blood there amongst the Israelis who pounce upon that particular Christian organization. And I've certainly heard the allegations that the Arabs indeed are the rulers of the world because of all their oil money. As though that could possibly effectively and effectively take the place of lobbying for Arab political concerns like the Israelis have very successfully done in Washington. Of course Israel is spying, says Uncle Sam, 11 May. Next the U.S. will pull the covers off one of these spies and show the world what a liar Israel is, again, in parentheses, again. the U.S. when the U.S. will cover. Someone wants to sabotage U.S.-Israel ties by AB5678. Newsflash to Yuval. I think you and your moronic buddies in the Israeli government have done and continue to do a great job of destroying the U.S. and Israel ties. Maybe it's time for some introspection before accusing others. How insightful. Such forthright, truthful reporting is overdue by CB. The fear of Congress over even the slightest remarks that will offend Israel's powerful supporters in the United States, along with the behind-the-scenes editorial decisions that gag major U.S. media from reporting on Israel in any but a flattering way has been outrageous for some time. It's of long duration. See John Judah's latest work on Harry Truman. Or how about profiles of super Zionist Sheldon Adelson that don't even mention Israel? The story in Newsweek is unprecedented. Sabotage? No. Simply truthful reporting, a refreshing change, and evidence of a new breeze blowing in the U.S., where liberty and justice for all is starting to take on real meaning. And I have, you see, some of these have 26 votes, 11, 10, 24. This one, somehow I left it off. I'm going to read it again because I really like the writing and I think it's the most pertinent and incisive reaction to the article. Such forthright, truthful reporting is overdue by CB. The fear of Congress over even the slightest remarks that will offend Israel's powerful supporters in the United States, along with the behind-the-scenes editorial decisions that gag major U.S. media from reporting on Israel in any but a flattering way, has been outrageous for some time. It's of long duration. See John Jurist's latest work on Harry Truman. Or how about profiles of super Zionist Sheldon Adelson that don't even mention Israel? Sheldon Adelson is like the literally 11th richest man in the world, making his money primarily off of casinos in Las Vegas and perhaps other places. The story in Newsweek is unprecedented. Sabotage? No, simply truthful reporting, a refreshing change, and evidence of a new breeze blowing in the U.S., where liberty and justice for all is starting to take on real meaning. Finally, this comment from a reader who calls themselves, "So the U.S. is lying?" Question mark. The only one who is undermining the relationship is Israel. The way you thumbed the U.S.'s nose during peace negotiations, trying to influence the last U.S. election, lying to the U.S. when Pollard was first caught, intimidating anyone who criticizes Israel in Congress, having the U.S. protect your illegal settlement enterprise internationally at the cost of the U.S. The list could go on and on. Don't worry, though. The Israeli lobby in the United States will keep those spineless politicians in check. And as stated by a U.S. intel officer, it's possible embarrass Israel. That's the way it's worded here. It's possible embarrassing. It might possibly embarrass Israel, I guess that person. Besides that last clause there, it's also those last two comments were really very well written and keenly to the point. All right. Hey, folks, it's 4:45 in the p.m., that's 1645 hours, Pacific Daylight Time here on the central coast of North America, namely California, of course. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, emanating by way of the frequency at 101.3 on the FM spectrum, 101.3 FM, and coming to you live and in person, and in person, and in person, on freakradio.org. Click on the red oval for the link. Okay. I see something familiar here. I've already talked about that. Oh, no, we don't want to see that either. Yeah, let's get back to my... Whoopsie. Yeah, that last piece I actually extracted from the American Task Force on Palestine daily news update, or it's more like a buy or try weekly news update. A little something from good old JVP, the Jewish Voice for Peace. How low will the Israel lobby go in order to preserve the oppression of Palestinians? Let's see. Yes, Secretary of State John Kerry unleashed. This is dated, according to my receiving it. This goes back to the beginning of May. And I did read this. I'm going to read it to you again because it's still pertinent. Secretary of State John Kerry unleashed the wrath of the Israel lobby this week when he used a painful but fair word to describe the direction he believes Israel is heading: apartheid. In fact, many of us, including high-ranking Israeli officials, believe that after 47 years of occupation, Israel already is a de facto apartheid state. But such unvarnished truth-telling is a threat to groups like the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, and the American Jewish Committee, the AJC, who came down hard on Kerry and helped pressure him to backtrack on his remarks. Unless we act now, says JVP here, and call out Israel lobby groups for trying to police the truth, they will continue to silence others with impunity. The AJC and ADL in particular claim to fight for the human rights of Jews and others. Yet they, along with AIPAC, are standing in the way of a lasting and just peace. By repeatedly acting as though telling the truth about unjust Israeli policies is a form of bigotry. As a Jew who has experienced real anti-Semitism, I resent it deeply. And Kerry's rapid response, including along mea culpa for using the term, was frankly an embarrassment, referring to his response to those ADL people like that and backtracking. Sidney Levy of JVP, who authored this beseechment here, wants you to join him in flooding the inboxes of AIPAC, the ADL, and the AJC with our message. They cannot stop people from speaking or knowing the truth about Israeli policies, and they cannot do it in the name of Jews and others who care about human rights. When it comes to Israel, what these groups care about is not human rights or democracy. They care about preserving the status quo, where Israel controls most of the land and rules over Palestinians against their will. Netanyahu talks about peace when he means more settlements. The lobby does exactly the same. Why are they more outraged about a solidarity word? I'm sorry, why are they more outraged about a solitary word, apartheid, than about Israel's continued settlement expansion and military occupation? Tell the Israel lobby that their actions are harmful to Palestinians and Israeli Jews, and the rest of us as well. The Israel lobby spoke. Now it is your time to reply. Best, Sidney Levy, who's head of some department or another of the Jewish Voice for Peace. National office, I'm sure. Yep, he said it. Kerry said it. So, here we have an example of the interactive quality of community radio here in Santa Cruz, California. I give you an action alert to take part in. You respond, right? Right. You want to contact, go to their, go to JVP's website, which is... Well, let me put it this way. Their Jewish Voice for Peace, their address is 1611 Telegraph Avenue. 1611 Telegraph Avenue, Suite 550, Oakland, California, 95612. Their email address, that's what I'm trying to say, is info@jewishvoiceforpeace.org. info@jewishvoiceforpeace.org. So that's one way you can get a hold of information about them or request to subscribe to their service, their website, their email list, I mean. And their specific website most likely is www.jvp.org or www.jewishvoiceforpeace.org. Just do a search. Just Google Jewish Voice for Peace. You can probably get away with Googling JVP, and you'll find out about this and many other action alerts and the latest that JVP is up to. These are truly honest to the core, unfettered, unintimidated, courageous American Jews and others who clearly state Israel does not speak for us, AIPAC does not. Benjamin Netanyahu does not speak for us American Jews. We are not all in unison. To be a good Jew is one thing. To be a fascist Zionist is something else. Okay, folks, I'm going to say goodbye now. It's been a really hell of a rough two hours. Again, not the most shining moment for Mideast migraines, but I promise, inshallah, God willing, or somebody willing, the goddess willing, I'll be here next Monday at 3 p.m. right on the mark, top of the hour, 3 o'clock p.m. every Monday for the weekly Monday edition of Mideast Migraines. Also, don't forget the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, where, having just recently completed Max Blumenthal's book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, all chapters of which are available at my archives, which is on another website, radioforall.net. Go to radio, the number 4, ALL.NET, radioforall.net. Load up Mideast Migraines and you'll receive the podcast for any and all portions of the book that you'd like to read. And that book having been completed, I've started on another book, a classic book on this whole general topic, classic in my mind, by former Congressman Paul Finley. It is entitled, the book is entitled, They Dare to Speak Out. People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby. I began that 2 days ago on the last Saturday edition of this program. They Dare to Speak Out by Paul Finley. Still very pertinent today, written 29 years ago. We can explore that book and compare it to the current circumstances surrounding Israel's effective control of U.S. congressional money and support of Israel's military that comes from the U.S. taxpayer and other related phenomenon. That's Saturday at 11 a.m. The Saturday edition of Mideast Migraine starts every Saturday, 11 o'clock in the morning. Thank you again. Thanks for supporting me and standing by me during my hour of darkness. Let's see. We're going to go now to last week's edition of the IMEMC's Palestine Today, the Week in Review. Thank you.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for May 10th to the 16th, 2014. Two Palestinian civilians were killed this week as the Israeli army attacked Nakba Day protests. Meanwhile, the American-mediated peace talks remain stalled. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.